Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Dr. Laura story right after this. In 1787, the writers of our Constitution put in this clause at Article 1, Section 10. It says, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debt." Now, that clause follows the biblical injunction on just weights and balances that we see in Leviticus 19:35. But private business is carried on in gold and silver coin. It's public business that's conducted in commercial paper like stocks, bonds, and Federal Reserve notes, credit cards, credit, debt, usury. Back in 1965, Congress said that there's no difference in the value of gold and silver coin as compared to clad coin or currency. And that's very true when we're dealing with banks, government, and commercial industries. But out here in the real marketplace, there's a 7-to-1 difference in purchasing power of gold over paper, and there's a 7-to-1 difference in the taxes that are due on that paper over gold. Now, God and our founding fathers did not give us gold and silver coin for no good purpose. They knew that as a matter of law, gold and silver coin was absolutely necessary for us to deal in order for us to establish our property rights. Well, neither did our Congress and politicians take our gold and silver coin away from us for no good reason either. And that's because they knew, and they knew full well back in 1933 when they did it, that in order to subjugate a free people, they must first take away the people's gold and silver coin to take away the people's right to property and to destroy those property rights, which was done under the first plank to the Communist Manifesto, which calls for the abolition of all right to property. So if we intend to regain our rights, duties, and capacities, then we must first regain our property and property rights, and that's because property is the legal foundation for all of our liberties. So let me teach you how to do just that. That's in our business school, which is now on compact disc for adult homeschool. Now, if you'd like more information about our private business school, call and order my free general law CD package first. That's the place to start. It's a 4-hour commentary on the law in general. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. You can call right now to order yours. The number 417-273-4967. Remember, our business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. Now, if you're online, go to the website, georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Click onto the email machine. Send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Again, georgegordon.org, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, our friend Christina Erickson, she asks another question. Question number 6. Remember, these questions are born in ignorance, are foolish, and they lack wisdom. And just as the next question illustrates, Christina asks, "I have a neighbor who insists on working on the Sabbath in violation of Exodus 35, verse 2. Well, Exodus 35, verse 2 clearly states that he should be put to death. Now, am I morally obligated to kill him myself? Let me begin by asking Christina this question. I have a neighbor who committed murder, and the laws of Missouri clearly state that he should be put to death. Am I morally obligated to kill him myself? Is this question foolish? Since when do we individuals carry out executions without a trial, without due process, without a defense, without equal protection, and without an appeal? Now, when this issue came up in Scripture, it was handled like this. Now, here's the citation. Remember, this is from, if you're keeping track of this, this is Exodus 35. Verse 2, it clearly states that he should be put to death. Now, while the children of Israel, now this is in, I think this is Exodus 35, I'm not quite sure. I don't have a citation down here. Follow along with me. You'll have to listen because I don't have the citation here for you to turn to. It says, "And while the children of Israel were in the wilderness, they found a man that gathered sticks on the Sabbath day. And they that found him gathered sticks," or gathering sticks, "brought him to Moses and Aaron and to all the congregation, and they put him in ward," put him in the dungeon. They put him in a cell, locked him up. Because it wasn't declared what should be done with him. In verse 35 here, "And the Lord said unto Moses, the man shall surely be put to death. All the congregation shall stone him with stones outside of the camp. And all the congregation brought him without the camp, and they stoned him with stones, and he died as the Lord commanded Moses." Let me turn over here to Exodus 35, and let's see if this is the right chapter. I've got verse 32 up here. Bear with me for a second here. 35, 32. Nope, that's not it. In verse 35, verse 2, it says, "6 days shall work be done, and on the seventh day there shall be to you a holy day, a Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Whosoever doeth work therein shall be put to death." All right. So, Christina cites Exodus 35, verse 2. And, let's see, I've got a citation here that tells a story about a guy. I think it's in Exodus. It's not chapter 35, and it starts in verse 32 through 36, and it's talking about this guy that is gathering sticks on the Sabbath day, and God said, "Well, what should we do to him? You should take him out and stone him." Not very kind, not very gentle. I mentioned to you last program, Andy Rooney on 60 Minutes, hell of a sharp-witted guy. He went through and critiqued the Ten Commandments one night. He got to the Sabbath, and he said that it's kind of ludicrous. It doesn't make any sense. Well, boys and girls, I don't know if it's ludicrous or not. I'm just reporting to you that the law requires that Sabbath breakers be stoned. It's a capital felony. So evidently, this God, I'm not talking about sweet Jesus, you know, in the Baptist church, or your God over here in the Methodist church, or your God in the Jewish synagogue. I'm talking about the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Moses. This guy thought Sabbath breaking was kind of a serious offense, and he attached capital punishment to it. For whatever reason. There it is. I'm a reporter. I'm not here to tell you whether it's good or bad or right or wrong or it's stupid or it's smart or whatever it is. I'm just reporting to you. That's the way the game is played. Now, this girl, Christina, trying to poke fun at the Bible and poke fun at God in her, I'm not even going to say misguided way. Misguided is my opinion of her. She thinks that she's well guided, that she's right on point, that she's as smart as a whip. Well, that's her opinion. I've got a different opinion. I don't know about Dr. Laura. I imagine Dr. Laura probably has a different opinion also of this concept here of making fun of and poking fun at the Scripture and at God. I don't think that this is the guy that you should be poking fun at. I mean, this guy is a nice guy, and he's got a pretty good sense of humor, but, you know, his sense of humor is a little bit different than most of us are used to. Most of us, you know, when we talk about sense of humor, we're thinking about Bob Hope. You know, we're thinking about Lucille Ball, or or something, you know, that's pretty funny, like Jay Leno, you know, or Letterman. We're thinking about humor. I mean, this guy's got a good sense of humor, but his sense of humor is a little different than what we call humor. For instance, he's got a law in here, and it says, if you catch a guy who's lying in court about some guy, you get a witness on the witness stand, like Mark Furman lying about O.J. Simpson, and you catch this guy lying, then God, the guy with the sense of humor that I'm describing here says, the punishment for the guy, the perjured witness, is whatever he thought to do to the guy he's testifying against shall be done to him. That's his sense of humor. I think that that's a sense of justice. It's a sense of righteousness. It's a sense of morality. It's a sense of humor in that, you know, he could say, a lying, perjured witness shall go to prison for 5 years and pay a $10,000 fine. There's no humor in that. That's just business. But here's where the humor comes in. He says, well, if you got a witness and he's committing perjury against somebody, let's do to him as he intended to do to the guy he was testifying against. And that's a big change in your sense of humor from Jay Leno to God Almighty. And that's the way he thinks. That's the way he behaves. So that's why I say he's got a good sense of humor. He's got a good sense, you know, of justice, and he's got his feet on the ground. And he came up with this penalty called death for Sabbath breaking. Now, when I was a kid in 1942-43, you know, during World War II, I lived in a little town called Corbell, California. And it was owned by, this town is owned by the lumber company. It's kind of like Tennessee Ernie Ford, you know, working at the mine and he's digging 16 tons and I owe my soul to the company store. Well, there was 102 houses in this little town. And there were 102 workers that worked in the mill that lived in those 102 houses. And you paid a dollar a day, $30 a month rent was the rent on this house. Some houses were a little better than others. So my granddad was the mill superintendent, and so we lived down in the four houses that were across from the mill office. And it was probably the four best houses in town. Prior to that, we lived over on the east side of Mad River, which ran right through town. And then up on the hill, Eddie Aldridge lived. He was the engineer on the logging train. And there was a guy named Daryl Dean Mitchell, and he was the brakeman on the lumber train. There were two trains. One hauled lumber down to Corbel X, and the other one went up into the woods, and Eddie Aldridge was the engineer on that one. And depending upon people's status in the mill is where they lived in the town. Not everybody was equal. And this mill ran Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and Saturday. But on Sunday, the world stopped. Now, you've got to describe this little town. There was a Texaco service station in the town, and it was owned by the mill, Northern Redwood Lumber Company. There was a cookhouse and a bunkhouse. They were owned by the lumber company. There was a Brizard's store. They owned the store, but they leased it to Brizard's, and Brizard's was the grocery store, see? Dry goods and grocery store. So there's about five or six of those, an ice cream store. You know, there's about five or six businesses here in this town. And they're all owned by the lumber company, and all the houses are owned by the lumber company. And the main business of the company is to cut down trees, cut them into boards, and sell the boards. This is World War II, kids. This is the time, if there was ever a time to work 7 days a week, 24 hours a day for the war effort, this was it. But I'm here to tell you, on Saturday night, the world stopped in Corbell, California, and every business closed, and on Sunday, Nothing was open. You couldn't buy a gallon of gas. You couldn't buy an ice cream cone. The cookhouse was closed. So if you were a single man living in the bunkhouse, you had to have food in your room in the bunkhouse to carry you through Sunday. Otherwise, you weren't going to eat because there was no place for you to eat. You couldn't go to the grocery store. You couldn't get a gallon of gas to drive someplace. And let me tell you, the rest of the countryside was just like it. Arcata was closed down. Eureka was closed down. We practiced the Sabbath in the United States of America, children, in 1942 in this country. Oh, you could argue you had it on the wrong day. You know, you could argue that maybe you didn't keep it the same way that the Baptists kept it, or the Mormons, or somebody else. But let me tell you, everybody kept the Sabbath. Nobody worked. Not at their regular jobs, because the world stopped. Now, we didn't stone people to death if they were out working or working on their cars or doing 55 other things. And you could come up with 55 different things that people ought to be stoned for. And this girl now, she says, he's working on the Sabbath. Let me ask you a question. What was he doing, Christina? Was he pulling an ox out of the ditch? Because that's an exception to the law. You know, a man who's got a cow that falls into the water hole, you could go get the tractor out and fire it up and throw a rope around her neck and drag her out of the water hole. And you could do that on the Sabbath. Because your ox had fallen in a ditch. If there was some emergency that had occurred, you know, then we would have a reason for doing some work on the Sabbath if there was an emergency. Then, of course, people would come up with 55 different things that are emergencies that may or may not be. But then I'm not going to split hairs here. But the point is, this girl is saying, well, what about me? Do I have a moral obligation to kill this guy? Obviously, she's just poking fun at this Sabbath law is what she's doing here. But are you really sure that we ought to be poking fun at this Sabbath law? Let me flip over here to Leviticus chapter 26. And let me tell you a little story here about the Sabbath thing. In verse 31, he says, I'm going to make your cities waste and bring your sanctuaries into desolation, and I'm not going to smell the savor of your sweet odors. And I'm going to bring the land into desolation, and your enemies, which dwell therein, shall be astonished at it. I'm going to scatter you among the heathen, and I'll draw out a sword after you, and your land shall be desolate and your cities waste. Then shall the land enjoy your Sabbaths as long as it lies desolate, and you be in your enemies' lands. Even then shall the land rest and enjoy your Sabbaths. As long as it lies desolate, it shall rest, because it did not rest in your Sabbaths, plural, when you dwelled upon it. Well, boys and girls, there are several Sabbaths. Let me describe them for you. There's a weekly Sabbath that occurs every Saturday. Most people celebrate it on Sunday, but then that's their choice. It's the wrong choice, but then that's their choice to make. And then there's seven annual Sabbaths. There's the first and last day of unleavened bread during the Passover. And then there's the Feast of Weeks and the Feast of Trumpets, Day of Atonement, Feast of Tabernacles, and Last Great Day. Seven annual Sabbaths, or holy days, in which we're told not to work, which carries the death penalty. And then we have two more Sabbaths over here. It's called a land Sabbath, once every 7 years, and then we have a Jubilee Sabbath, once every 50 years. Failure to participate, failure to execute these Sabbaths is a capital felony punishable by death. So there's 10 Sabbaths spoken of in the Scripture. Weekly Sabbath, seven annual Sabbaths, that's eight, and two, one every 7 years and one every 50 years. That's 10 Sabbaths to observe, and they carry the death penalty. Now just picture the United States of America with 300 million people destroyed in war, conquered, occupied, and then the people deported from the land to every land in the world. That's the penalty for Sabbath breaking. Now, kids, I would contend that Sabbath is a whole lot more serious than you have probably been led to believe. you know, they tell you, well, you'll go to hell if you don't go to church on Sunday. No, sir, that's not the penalty. Going to hell for not going to church on Sunday is probably good religion and belongs in Catholicism, belongs in Christianity. But it doesn't come from the Bible. It doesn't belong in the law of God. It isn't in the law of God, and that's not the penalty. Going to hell is not the penalty for Sabbath breaking. But national captivity is. And death is. And death, boys and girls, is pretty serious. Pretty heavy-duty stuff. Now, this girl sees no further than poking fun. Here's a case of a Sabbath breaking. It's a capital felony. Notice that this is the first execution this side of the Exodus. It's a public execution after trial and sentence. Notice here, this guy is brought up on a capital felony, Sabbath breaking, tried, convicted, and executed. And it was done by the congregation. It wasn't done by one person acting as a single vigilante. Where in the hell does this crazy vigilante justice come from? You know, they had a kid out here in Colorado some years back. And it was alleged that he was gay. Sodomite. Young kid. I don't know. He's 20 years old, something like that. And two guys took this kid out, tied him up to a fence here in Wyoming. I forget exactly how they killed him. They beat him up or tied him out and left him to exposure, and he died. Well, they caught these guys, and they made a real big scene, you know, out of this thing of discrimination. They discriminated against this guy because he was gay, and they killed him, and people were just really, really sickened by it. You know, I wasn't sickened by it per se. He was probably, if he was guilty, now see, I don't even know if the guy was gay. It was alleged that. I've never seen anybody prove it. This guy who was alleged to be gay never had an opportunity to face, confront, and cross-examine his two primary accusers, the two guys that killed him. He didn't have a jury trial. The two guys that killed him got a jury trial. They got to face, confront, and cross-examine their accusers. You know, did it ever occur to you that this concept of justice, of a fair trial, of notice and opportunity to defend with a right to appeal, comes from the Bible, the Ten Commandments? It comes from God? Our judicial process, kids, comes from the Mosaic Law. We practice it to this day. Oh, we've corrupted it and perverted it and polluted it and done all that. But, you know, basically that's where this whole concept comes from. That's where it comes from. So if we would do that for two murderers of a sodomite, shouldn't this guy, who's alleged to be a Sabbath breaker, who's also worthy of death? I mean, the sodomite is worthy of death, and he ought to be prosecuted. He ought to be given a trial, and then when we find him guilty, we ought to take him out, and we ought to execute him. And he ought to be executed publicly by stoning, not privately by lethal injection. Just the way the law requires. Now, of course, we've come to a different conclusion than in criminality. We're smarter than God. We know more than God. We know when we should do away with death penalties, and when we should apply them, and when we should lock people up in jail, etc., and when we shouldn't. And God and the justice system that was established by God through Moses at Mount Sinai, we saw that wasn't good, and so we changed that. You know, we're smarter than God, and we changed that. Now, here's this girl comes along. Her name is Christine, and she says, gee, let me poke a little fun at this. Let me rub a little salt here in the wound. And I don't think that the Sabbath is something to be making a joke over. I think it's pretty serious. You got 300 million people in this country. I would imagine there's probably about 5 million people out of 300 million people that keep the Sabbath, the weekly Sabbath. People like Seventh-day Adventists. Okay, now let's try this. Seventh-day Adventists keep the weekly Sabbath. Breaking the weekly Sabbath is a capital felony for which the other 295 million people are guilty and worthy of death, and these 5 million people, we'll call them Sabbath keepers, that is the Seventh-day Adventists and the Seventh-day Baptists and the little splinter groups around here, they're keeping the Sabbath day. And let's assume that they're keeping the Sabbath day on the right day of the week, Saturday. Okay. Now you've got 7 annual holy days. Are you Seventh-day Adventists practicing the 7 annual holy days, which are also capital felonies, which are also what will get you killed, punished? Okay. Well, then that eliminates the Seventh-day Adventists because they don't practice the annual holy days. So that brings us down by about 5 million. And there's a few hundred thousand people in the country that practice the Sabbath day on Saturday and the 7 annual holy days. And they practice those 7 annual holy days. Okay, well now, those guys won't be destroyed, but everybody else will be. Now let's try the third two Sabbaths. Land Sabbaths and Jubilees. For all of you splinter groups out there, do you practice the Land Sabbaths and the Jubilees? Boys and girls, how many people in the country do you think practice the weekly Sabbath on Saturday, the 7 annual holy days on the correct days, and then the two Sabbaths on the Land Sabbaths and Jubilees? All capital felonies. Don't you think, boys and girls, that you're getting down to just a few people left? I think that's why Andy Rooney said, I think that Sabbath thing is just plain stupid. Well, kids, just because nobody practices the Sabbath is hardly grounds for calling it stupid. Silly. Foolish. I didn't make it. And I find myself just as bound by it as Moses was and the Israelites were. I'm one of the heirs and assigns forever. I don't have a problem doing the Sabbath every week or the 7 annual Sabbaths or the Land Sabbaths and Jubilees. Americans seem to be able to do the Sabbath on Sundays. They seem to be able to practice Christmas, Easter, New Year's, Memorial Day, Labor Day, and the 4th of July without any problem. You know, they seem to be able to farm, and they seem to be able to rotate their crops when they want to and go to ag school and put fertilizer on their ground and determine for themselves whether or not they want to fertilize their ground by letting it rest once every seventh year or by buying chemical fertilizers from Monsanto. They're able to make those decisions, and I would sit here and argue that if you can make those kinds of decisions, you could just as easy make these same kinds of scriptural decisions and follow God and keep His commandments. If you wanted to, if you so desired. All right, now our girl Christina over here doesn't have any desire to keep the Sabbath. She has a desire to make fun of it. I personally don't see anything that's that funny about it. Now, I can see that she's kind of silly, that she's kind of nonsensical. I expect that out of a college kid. Other than spring break and getting laid in the back of your boyfriend's Chevy van, I don't think the average college girl has much more on her mind than that. So let me give you a historical note. We Americans practiced the Sabbath in this country until 1950. And in the little town that I grew up in Corbell, California, during World War II, the mill closed down on Sunday. No stores were open, not even the cookhouse. Now, boys and girls, we Americans could practice the Sabbath, whether we had it on the right day or the wrong day, but by God, we could practice the Sabbath 50 years ago. We didn't seem to have any problem doing that. So these kinds of laws against Sabbath breaking, sodomy, blasphemy, adultery were called blue laws. They have been repealed all across the nation, but only in the last 50 years. In the first 150 years of our country, your granddaddy and great-great-granddaddy and great-great-great-granddaddy back into colonial times, they saw a value for Sabbath keeping, and they did it. Now, the legislatures have legalized prostitution, adultery, blasphemy, abortion and sodomy. But that doesn't make it right. But political power comes from the muzzle of a gun. Now, old Mao Zedong, you know, a pretty wise guy. He had a lot of street sense. Mao Zedong, a wicked, evil fellow. But not a dummy. He made an observation. He said, political power comes from the muzzle of a gun. Well, I think the guy's exactly right. Political power comes from the muzzle of a gun. Question arises, well, who's got the most political power? The God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God of Moses, or the God of the United States, France, and Germany? You know, it's a choice that we have to make. I took a look at Daniel in the lion's den. I came to the conclusion that the God of Moses had more power than the king of Babylon. I took a look at Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace, and I came to the conclusion that the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob had more political power than Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon. The same God who gave us these laws also has the political power to enforce them, as we see from Noah's flood, the Exodus, and the Romans' destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. I would contend that it is not wise to give the finger to the judge just before he passes sentence. Just my conclusion. All right, so there's the answer to that. I think that it's kind of stupid to sit here and ask a question like, you know, should I kill this guy myself? The real thrust of that argument is, I'm going to make fun of and give the finger to the originator of this Sabbath day over here, and I'm sitting here asking the question, children, do you really think it's wise to be giving this guy the finger and making fun of his Sabbath day? He's not likely to cotton to that. He's not very likely to take that very well, based upon what he tells us here in Leviticus 26, 31 through 35. He said, now for this Sabbath breaking, I'm going to send you into national captivity. Now you Canadians and Australians ought to take notes, because we Americans, Australians, and Canadians got out of World War II unscathed. We're not going to get out of World War III unscathed. It's just about our turn. It's coming up. Hey, let me remind you that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide, over the Internet. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. And the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, just go to the homeschooling page. The Law Hour website is updated every week. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through that same webpage. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date, for your listening convenience. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest, and the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. And we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour, an editorial review, brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events from the scriptural perspective 7 days a week. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. But they should. For more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website, georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. All right, number seven, Christina Erickson asks this question or makes this comment. She says, a friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, according to Leviticus 11, verse 10, it is a lesser abomination than homosexuality. I don't agree. Can you settle this? Well, indeed I can settle this, Christina. You're right. Your friend is wrong. But let's analyze the statute and let's understand why you are right and why your friend is in error. Now, please note that I have cited the whole statute here. You know, you're citing one verse, Leviticus 11, verse 10. So, let's take a look at Leviticus 11, verse 10 in context, beginning in verse 9. These shall you eat of all that are in the waters, whatsoever has fins and scales in the waters, in the seas, and in the rivers, them shall you eat. In verse 10, and all that have not fins and scales in the seas and in the rivers, and all that move in the waters, and of any living thing which is in the waters, they shall be an abomination unto you. They shall be even an abomination unto you. You shall not eat of their flesh, but you shall have their carcasses in abomination. Whatsoever hath no fins nor scales in the waters, that shall be an abomination unto you. All right, well, it depends on how you're raised in life as to whether or not the foods that you eat are abominable. Now, over in the Philippines and Indonesia, rat is a delicacy. And people go out and they kill rats. And they bring them in. And I was watching one guy, he had a picture of him. He had about 10 rats in each hand, holding them by the tails. Probably 10 in each hand, probably 20 rats. And then he's walking down this dusty road in the Philippines, and there's a cat. It was in the National Geographic where I saw this picture, and it's a story about the Philippines, and this guy is taking protein home to his family. And I imagine they take those rats, and they gut them and clean them and fry them up, and, you know, Mrs. Filipino housewife, you know, she's just real smart about it, you know. It's kind of like, like she's cooking the ham for Sunday dinner, you know. Now, quite frankly, I personally, if I was confronted with a rat and somebody said, you got to eat this rat, I would go hungry. I wouldn't eat. How long would I go hungry and how long would I not eat if I had just a rat to choose from? Would I starve to death? Well, I would try very hard. I would really earnestly try to starve to death rather than eat a rat. Now, those people see that as being really good. I was down in Louisiana some years back, and my wife and I, we were driving down the road in the motorhome, and we saw this restaurant. It looked like a pretty nice place, and she said, well, I kind of feel like some seafood today, don't you? And I said, well, it sounds all right to me. Let's stop and go in there. And this is Louisiana. You know, Louisiana is famous for seafood and cooking. And so we went into this restaurant. Now, remember, we're Hebrews, and we're a little bit odd ducks, you know, but that doesn't mean that we don't eat fish. Fish that have fins and scales, you know, like salmon have fins and scales. Catfish have fins, but they don't have scales. So we don't eat catfish because the statute here is very explicit and it says whatsoever doesn't have fins and scales. Got to have both. Now, turtles have scales and snakes have scales, but they don't have fins. Therefore, the turtle and the snake is unclean, and the salmon is clean. And then we have another class of seafood. The seafood, or we have a class of seafood which we call crabs, shrimp, lobster, shellfish. They call it. Okay. Well, the shellfish, they don't have scales or fins. And God says you'll hold them as an abomination. Now, to me, a rat is an abomination. I remember one time I was over at Duncan, Oklahoma, at Heritage Library. And I'd been invited there, and I delivered a series of lectures, and there was a young woman in there from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And during the lecture, I don't know how it came up, but I'd mentioned something about clean and unclean. And she's a very serious young woman. And unlike this Christina, I know she wasn't a lippy woman. She was very serious. And she said, "Well, Mr. Gordon, you mentioned that you practice the Mosaic dietary laws." I said, "Yeah, I do." And she said, Now, are there any exceptions to those laws? And I said, not that I can think of. I wouldn't make any exception to eating rat or lobster or pig or something like that. And so she said, "Well, let's picture a sequence of events. Let's suppose that you went to church, and while you were at church, the pastor invites you over to his house for Sunday dinner. And so you go over to Sunday dinner at the pastor's house, and they're serving baked ham. Would you be so rude as to refuse to take just a little bit of ham to be sociable and to be polite?" And I said, "Well, now that makes a lot of sense. You stop and think about it. You're over at somebody's house, over at your mother-in-law's house, over at your brother or sister-in-law's house, and they're serving something that you don't like hominy or grits or something, you know. And so to be polite, to be sociable, when they pass you the hominy, you take a spoonful. And when they pass you the grits, you take a spoonful and you sit there and choke it down, you know, whether you like it or not, don't you? I mean, isn't that what your daddy taught you how to do that?" Well, I said, "Well, in normal society, I can see your point there, but let's suppose that I invite you over to my house, young lady, and I'm having baked wharf rat. Now, would you be so rude and obnoxious as to refuse to take just one front leg to be sociable and to be polite at my dinner table?" And she said, "Oh, I see what you mean." And that word abomination there is something that you develop. It's a mental attitude. You know, soldiers that go through special training in the Army, the Rangers and guys like that. I had a brother-in-law. My brother-in-law was an Air Force captain. And they taught him that if he gets shot down, you know, and he bails out of his plane and there he is in the middle of enemy territory, that he might have to survive off the land for a period of days until he's picked up or until he makes his way back to friendly lines. And so he went down to Panama, and they killed snakes down there, and they ate them. And they ate insects and bugs. And he said, "You know, it's a matter of getting beyond the mental, the psychology of it, or the mental picture that you have of this food. Because really, a cooked snake, if you didn't know that it was snake, then you wouldn't know that it wasn't hamburger, or that it wasn't chicken, or that it wasn't something else." He said, "It's true." He said, "What happens is you catch the snake, and then you kill it, you cut its head off, you gut it, you skin it, and then you cut it up, and you stick it on a stick, and then you cook it over the fire. Now, what's the difference between taking a piece of meat off of a beef cow and doing the same thing and sticking it and cooking it over the fire?" He said, in the one case, you know that it's beef, and in the next, you know it's a snake. It's just a matter of getting over the mental hang-up. And he said, "Actually, taste-wise, you couldn't tell the difference." Now, when God told you not to eat snake and not to eat pig and fat and blood, he was telling you that those are part of the health laws. There's 18 of these health laws, and the reason for these health laws is to keep you from developing Parkinson's disease or cancer or heart attack or stroke. That's the purpose behind these health laws. not everything that you could put in your mouth is good for food. Now, if you take a cow, cows are vegetarians. Cows are vegetarians. And they're designed with four stomachs, and they do vegetation quite well. They don't eat meat. They don't eat heavy-duty protein like cheese, you know. Bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwiches. You know, you haven't seen your local cow eating a BLT. Now, in 1943, we Americans decided that what we needed to do was to increase the protein content of our grain, which had fallen from 24% in 1880 to around 18% by 1942. So to make up that difference, we decided to use bypass protein. So we went into the slaughterhouses and we took this waste offal material, just, you know, the guts and waste and blood and stuff like that. And we just took it and we dried it, ground it up into powder, and started putting that into the cattle feed. It's called bypass protein. Over the years, we discovered that it causes mad cow disease. You see, there's a health law. The cow wouldn't eat that meat. If you took that offal and you threw it out on the ground, the cow wouldn't go over there and sniff it and eat it. She would walk away from it. And the guy that would come over and eat it would be a buzzard. Now, he'd come over and eat it, or a dog or a coyote. They'd come right over there and eat those guts, eat that offal, because they think that's good. See, dogs and coyotes and buzzards, they have a digestive system with a high concentration of acid, and they can digest it. Humans can't. So God, you know, came along and said, "Hey, listen, let me tell you what kind of fuel to put in your body so that you can get that maximum 70 to 80 years of useful lifespan out of it." It's kind of like, "Hey, let me tell you how to change the oil in your car and change the oil filter so that you can get 100 or 200,000 miles out of that engine." That's the purpose behind it. So Christina comes along here. She wants to poke fun at this, and she says, "A friend of mine feels that even though eating shellfish is an abomination, it's a lesser abomination than homosexuality, and I don't agree. Can you settle this?" Well, the reason that I said that Christina is correct is this: the wages of sin is death. Death is final. Death is serious business. And whether you die from AIDS dementia because you're practicing sodomy, or you die from cancer because you're eating pig or shellfish, boys and girls, you're just as dead. Dead, you know. Death is death. Now, God comes along and he says, "Now with sodomites, I want you in the community to take that guy physically out and stone him to death. But when you see a guy over here eating turtle soup, I don't want you to take him out and stone him to death." You see, eating unclean food does not ascribe with it or to it a capital felony or capital punishment. But the results are the same. The natural results, and here's an important factor for us to learn a little lesson from, and that's this. In the Bible, we have laws, and the law says, "You shall not eat pig." Just because God has not instructed us to take people who eat pig out and stone them to death does not mean that people that eat pig are going to live long, trouble-free lives. They're going to die. They're going to die from trichinosis. They're going to die from some side effect from eating the pig: cancer, heart attack, stroke, or something else. One of these long, slow, continuous diseases that takes many, many years for you to die from. Now, if that's what you want to do, get after it. I'm not here to moralize with you. I'm not here to argue with you. I don't care what you eat. There's a statement that God makes in the Bible. He says, "You will be reformed by your own doings." You will be reformed by your own doings. People that eat unclean foods get disease. That's the penalty that you get for eating these unclean foods. Now, it's an abomination, and God told us to hold these animals, these critters, in abomination. He said, when you see a rat, you know, just picture this. It's an abomination to me. It's an abominable critter. Rats, you know, serve a function in the ecosystem, as do coons, possums, snakes, insects. You know, everything in the ecology or the ecological system is there for a purpose, and we ought to take care of it. You ought to take care of the coons and possums and the crickets and the grasshoppers, you know, and they should be in balance. You know, grasshoppers make good bird food. Birds eat insects. Birds are designed to eat insects. We need insects to feed the birds. Coons fill in a portion of the ecological system, as do skunks and porcupines and possums and deer. And, you know, everything that's out there is made for a purpose, and it's made for us, and it's good. It's part of creation, and it's all good. But God came along and he said, but not everything is good to eat. Not everything is good for human beings to eat. In the same way that there are lots of different fuels. You know, there's jet fuel for jet airplanes. There's high-octane aviation gasoline for certain airplanes. There's low-octane gasoline for certain airplanes. There's diesel fuel for diesel engines. But boys and girls, diesel fuel is not good in jet airplanes. High-octane gasoline for airplanes is not necessarily good for your car, and it won't work well in your Peterbilt diesel. Our common sense tells us to put the right kind of fuel into the engine that it's designed for and that it works in to give you maximum performance and maximum longevity of life. So United Airlines is careful to put JP8 into their jet engines. But, you know, we don't go out here and buy JP8 and put it in our diesel trucks, do we? I mean, come on, guys. You know, if I said, hey, Hank, let's fill up, you know, at the next truck stop, let's fill up with JP8, you know, you'd look over at me and say, are you out of your cotton picking mind? Hey, let's put high test aviation gas, 130 octane, into this diesel truck. Let's see how it runs, Bob. And then people want to eat rats. Well, you know, I don't care. Nothing to me. If you want to eat rat, go ahead and eat it. I think I'll pass. I'll let it slide. You can have my share. Now, when God told you not to eat these certain foods over here and to hold them in abomination, he wasn't whistling Dixie. The first clue as to why you're correct in your concluding that sodomy is a greater crime than eating shellfish is that sodomy is punishable by death. See Leviticus 20, verse 13. The penalty for eating shellfish is disease or toxic poisoning, such as cancer or mercury poisoning from eating oysters. Of the 24 crimes requiring the death penalty, eating shellfish is not on the list. Eating shellfish is not on the list. So I guess congratulations, Christina, you got one right. But, you know, sodomy is an abomination. You know, sin in general is an abomination. Crime. You know, we don't care much for child molesters, do we? Bank robbers. I think we've got more tolerance for bank robbers than we do child molesters. Or child murderers. You know, killing somebody is bad, but killing a child is even worse, isn't it? I mean, just take a look at the war going on now over in the Middle East. You know, we don't like killing civilians, but we like killing soldiers. And I gotta ask the question, well, what is it about killing soldiers that's so much better than killing civilians? What is it about killing adult civilians that's so much better than killing little children? It would seem like to me that the law that says thou shalt do no murder should apply to soldiers, civilians, little children. That would apply to everybody, shouldn't it? I mean, when was the last time you said, well, I guess I'm tired of living. I've lived long enough. It's time for me to be killed. I'm an old man, and I'm not ready to die yet. I'm still sitting here hoping to live to be 80. And when I get to be 80, I'll be hoping to live to be 90. When I live to be 90, I'll hope that I can live to be 100. When I'm 100, I'm sure I'm going to be sitting there, gee, I wonder if I could live to be 110. Nobody in his right mind wants to die. And sin is the transgression of the law. And the wages of sin is death. Death, kids, is kind of final. And when you're 23 or 32 or 41, you know, you can sit there with a cocktail at the party snorting coke and having a good time. But when you get to be 65, 70, or 75, you know, you're down to your last few years. And you recognize that. See, when I'm 67, I can recognize that I'm down to my last 36 months. That's all I got under the contract, 36 more months. That's kind of final. Now, when somebody dies, like my dad died, my granddad died, my grandma died, my Aunt Bessie died, my Uncle Buster died, that's pretty final. You know, time was when I could get on the telephone, call my Aunt Bessie. I can't call her anymore. She's gone. When you have somebody in your family that dies, death is pretty final. Now, fortunately, there's a resurrection. In fact, there's three of them. Fortunately, my Aunt Bessie is going to come up in the second resurrection. I guess she could come up in the first resurrection, but I haven't seen any indications from the scripture that she could qualify for the first resurrection, but, you know, maybe. But if she doesn't make the first, she'll make the second. She'll come up in the second resurrection. My Aunt Bessie's going to live again with my granny and my granddad and my father. I will meet them. And I will talk with them again. But right now I can't. They're gone. And because they're gone, death is final. So you should understand that. This isn't something to be joking about. Isn't something to be kidding about. Sin is serious because sin produces death. The wages of sin is death. Now to obviate that, why don't you consider, gee, if I would stop eating these unclean animals, maybe I would not get cancer. It's kind of like smoking. Years ago, you know, I used to be a smoker. I smoked a pack of Camel Studs every day. I was reading the Reader's Digest, and I read the story about smoking causes cancer. And I said, oh, my God, maybe I better quit. And the doctors, they keep telling you, you know, if you'll quit smoking today, your lungs will clear out. If you'd quit eating pig today, did you know that every 7 years, all of your cells in your body clean out? It's never too soon to start. You just quit eating pig, quit eating shellfish, you know, you quit smoking, and your life will not disintegrate or degenerate, and your health will improve. And as your health improves, you stand a better chance of living to be 65, 70, 75, or 80. And that's just common sense, and you know it as well as I do. All right, so we're about out of time. I've got to leave it right there. We'll pick up Christina, and we'll take a look at Priest's Defects, number 8, next time on the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Let me remind you that you've been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review, sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. If you'd like more information, the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. Hey, we're out of time. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course, talking about the Dr. Laura story. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.